Okay, you were elected to the House in 1958 and you went to the House Banking Committee immediately.
That's correct.
Do you remember to what extent, if at all, Congress was blaming the Fed for the 57-58 recession? Was that at all an issue?
Might have been, but I don't remember at that time. I don't think it was too serious. You had people like Patman who were jumping on the Fed for anything they had a chance to, but I don't think it was very serious.
Do you remember it coming up the next time around in the 1960 recession?
Excuse me?
Do you remember the issue coming up the next time around in the
1960s?
The
time there was a recession, you know, they started jumping on the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they did, but it was nothing very serious. Bill Martin didn't have any problem at all turning that off.
What was it like being from Indiana? Ordinarily, one assumes that, at least at this time, anything west of the Mississippi River made you a populist and against high interest rates. Didn't
well, let me correct your geography. Indiana's east of the Mississippi.
I know, but my question is, was there anything to that in Indiana?
Oh, no, there really was, and I had one bias that really shocked the people at the Fed and Bill Martin. I think I took a graduate degree in economic theory. And my tutor was Sumner Schlichter, and for my PhD's orals, and old Schlichter was convinced that the country needed a little inflation to keep the wheels moving. He said that inflation is the grease that keeps the country moving, and the Fed didn't like that at all.
What about the prominent politicians from Indiana at that time, Charlie Halleck and later
Charlie
Sarkey?
He was the minority leader of the House, the Marvin.
Right, sure.
Yeah, great guy.
What did they think? What were their attitudes in general toward the Fed? Live and let live, or were they in
the populist
stuff?
They didn't really pay much attention to it. That was not their thing. They didn't believe there was much hay to be made in monetary theory or in economics. Unless you were really in a bad depression. That wasn't their business. They couldn't make a good political go out of it.
Did you ever have any...
And he cautioned me to stay off of it, too. Go ahead.
Which Halleck did?
Yeah. Everybody, all my friends. And they said, Joe, this is bad politics. Stay out of it. Unless it's jobs, they said, forget it.
Why were there people on the banking committee then? Was it primarily because there was housing legislation involved?
That is correct. That was very crucial legislation.
Okay, well, we'll get back to that.
And I got on there because I was interested. As I said, I had master's degree in economic theory, and I was fascinated with the economy of the United States, the economics, and the international implications of especially. So I had one hell of a time on there. I really had a great time. I was old Sam Rayburn's gopher at that time, too. When I was elected, Lyndon Johnson was very kind to me. He helped elect me, and I got to know him pretty well. And when he got elected, he told me before he left town, that when he was in town 2 or 3 days, that if I got myself elected, to write him a note. And I did, and called him. And he said, listen, he said, now, Joe, he said, you call the speaker, you write the speaker a note. And said, lay it on heavy. He said, he is not immune to flattery. So I did just that. And then when I came to Washington, Johnson took me over to meet the speaker. And he said, now, Mr. Speaker, he said, look what we got ourselves here. He said, we got ourselves an economist. He said, we ain't never had an economist around here before. He said, we got one now, and he said, I know him. He's not a bad fellow. I helped elect him. And so Rayburn and Johnson were both very suspicious men. And on the basis of that recommendation, when Rayburn needed information, he would call me, and he'd send me down to talk to Bill Martin, or he'd send me over to the World Bank to talk to Gene Blacker, down to the IMF to talk to Perry Jochumsen, and it was kind of fun. All I had to do was call the speaker, wants me to come down talking to you. I was right in the door. I had a lot of fun doing that. Being a gopher wasn't so bad after all.
Well, there was one other economist in Congress, and that was Paul Douglas.
That is correct.
He was
a very
Senate.
Eminent economist.
That's right.
He was my tutor when I was in the graduate school. No, he wasn't my tutor. He ran a seminar that I attended, and when I was in the graduate school, when I was in the
a riot.
He was a marvelous fellow. You're right. I should have amended that statement. I think I was the first one in the Alps.
Yep. Yes. Let me just, while we mention him, let me just ask you about Paul Douglas. Was he always supportive of the Fed? There were times when he was critical.
Paul was a very independent fellow. He called him the way he saw.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very strong-minded man. I remember one time I got in a big argument with him, and I put the Treasury staff people on the researching some of his literature. And I found a quote that I thought was made my point. I went down and showed it to him. He said, Joe, he said, my co-author wrote that one.
Oh. That's
get ahead of it.
Yeah, that's great. Then you went into the Treasury in 1960 with Kennedy.
Right.
I've
been defeated in that election.
Right, it was a close election. In general, how would you characterize the influence of the Treasury versus the Council under Kennedy? Was it clear from the beginning that that Kennedy would listen?
Not quite. They had, who the hell was that guy's name?
In the Council?
Yeah.
Heller.
Old Waller, yes, of course, they had Old Waller. He's a very ambitious man.
Yes.
And he was going to take on the Treasury. But Waller had one problem. The Treasury had the operating authority, and final analysis of the President wanted something that he had to come to us. Waller had the theoretical authority. That was but he was a very powerful man. He made something to that council. He was the first man ever to do it.
Did you have any contact with the other members of the council, James Tolman and Kermit Gordon?
Sure did. Old Tolman was from Illinois. He was another Midwesterner.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim and I were very good friends. And Kermit Gordon was a dear, dear friend. He moved over and ran the, went down to Brookings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Kermit was a good friend. His wife bought a dog for my wife. Yeah, they had one of my Labradors. So
no.
it was a good family friend. They were close friends.
That's funny. Tolman's special interest was debt management. He was wanted to lengthen the material.
He was absolutely right, too.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't get that by Patman or any of these other guys. They said, oh, hell, why do we want to be able to take money to lengthen the debt? Jim Tolman agreed with the other big advocate of lengthening the debt was Mr. Robert Anderson, who was Secretary of the Treasury under Eisenhower.
Hmm.
And he and Jim, there weren't many people who were really interested in lengthening the debt in those days, but Jim and Bob Anderson were. I was, too. I thought it was terrible.
The interest rate ceiling on long-term debt wasn't binding at that point, was
it? Yeah.
Issue long-term debt. What did Bob Rosa think? He was the author of the Operation Twist, whereby the Fed was going to rearrange the maturity of its portfolio and issue more short-term debt and less more long-term debt and less short-term debt. Did you have contact with him?
Oh, yeah, Bob is a very close friend. He and I were in the final competition for a Rhodes Scholarship back in 1900. What year was that? That was, must have been 1939. And he won. And I won another scholarship and was off to the university. I was going to London School of Economics. A war broke out, neither of us got to go. So we both went to Harvard instead. And Bob was up there. I didn't know him well at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
I knew him fairly well when I was in the Congress. Bob was quite a politician. He liked to hang around with politicians. So he came down a lot, and we came into the Treasury. He was a very good friend. He recently died, you know.
Yes, I know, about a year and a half ago.
He died of Alzheimer's.
Hmm.
Too bad. He had a marvelous wife. His wife was an expert on the Russian Chamber of Commerce.
Hmm.
He had a daughter, beautiful daughter.
Right, she's still alive. She has all his papers, too.
Said yes.
Hmm.
Bob was a very interesting fellow. And when the mood was on him, he could write well.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of us, he did some damn fool things. I'll never forget the interest equalization tax. That was the craziest thing I ever had anything to do with.
So that was his idea.
Yeah, it was his idea. But we were, in those days, we were on the gold standard. People forget it. old center, Rhea Hattin's right by the neck. First thing a lot of them said, well, I didn't do this much, but every now and then even I did that. He'd call running about 4 o'clock in the morning to see what happened to Gold 60. That was really crucial.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that later, especially in 1968. Yeah. So Rosa had the idea of Operation Twist to keep short-term rates up to help the balance of payments, keep long-term rates down to a health investment. I've had people tell me different things about that. I've had some people tell me that he didn't take it that seriously. It was mostly a way of placating Tobin at the council and giving the Fed some flexibility to raise short-term rates. And I've had other people tell me he took it very seriously and really believed that the Treasury could move.
I'm only talking on this, but it was my impression he took it very seriously indeed.
Yeah. Well, that would go along with...
he played it pretty close to his chest. I couldn't be really sure. He was a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my impression.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes along with... his views at the New York Fed was very interventionist as far as
that's
markets.
True. Bob was an interventionist fellow.
Mm-hmm.
Believe in the standing on the sidelines.
He was a student.
And then do something.
He was a student of John Williams.
Yeah, up in Harvard. We both were.
This was before my time, but if somebody asked you, well, what's the difference between the kind of standard Keynesian at the time, like Alvin Hansen, and somebody like John Williams, what would you have told them?
I wouldn't say a hell of a lot. I think most of them. We were all a bunch of Keynesians at that time.
Right.
Yeah. There wasn't much difference on it.
Mm-hmm.
Had a bigger green eye shade than John Williams.
Did you take a course from Williams?
Yeah, both of them.
What was the course? Do you remember?
No, I don't. My God, that's...
Sure, well...
Years ago. Can't remember that. Hansen, yes, I do remember him. This is something on history, economic history of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then he was an advisor when we were down in the Treasury. He used to come down and tell us how to run the Treasury with a group of professional economists who came in. So I saw a lot of those, Alvin. Didn't see much of John. I don't think he came back after
Harvard. He was an advisor for the New York Fed.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting that one would have chosen Alvin Hansen. He didn't think much of money and financial markets. Everything for him was on the real side, the fiscal, the deficit. I would have thought he would be doing more advising for the council than the Treasury.
Would you repeat that?
I would have thought he would have been more a council person than a Treasury person.
Well, maybe he was. I know he was down there telling us how to run the Treasury.
The economists were brought in with the idea of countering the...
economists were brought in, really, Doug Dillon and Bob, Stan Suri, Joe Fowler, and I. All of us loved the academic give and take. And so we had a council of economists that came down about every month, once a month or every other month. It was a shifting kind of a panel, and they came down and talked to us about everything.
No, I was talking about the economists that you brought in a number of very good economists at the time. Dewey Dane, Peter Sternlein.
Dewey was there on the staff.
Mm-hmm. But they were good economists.
Yeah, sure.
But that was new from the Anderson Treasury.
Yeah, well, that's true. Oh. We brought in Dewey Dane. We brought in, Rosa brought in... Paul Volcker.
Mm-hmm.
We had some very good economists. And Stan Suri, who was the Assistant Secretary in charge of taxation, was fascinated by the interaction of economic theory and tax theory. So he used them a lot, too.
Let's get back to some of the international problems and some of the mechanisms that Rosa came up for dealing with balance of payments problems. Do you remember anything about the initiation of the swap lines and the use of the Exchange Stabilization Fund to intervene in the foreign exchange market?
Yes, indeed.
That would have started fairly early in 61.
Exactly.
The dollar was...
Have any rest, but the minute we hit, they were starting to run on the dollar, you know. We had one hell of a time, right? The first
Yeah, it's hard to believe, but the lira was strong relative to the dollar.
And the French franc was quite strong, too. Our biggest buddy in those days were the Italians.
How do you say that, your biggest buddies?
The biggest friends we had on the international side were the Italians.
How was
that?
What was
that central banker's name?
Guido Carli.
Guido Carli. Oh, Guido had this marvelous painting up on his wall of St. Michael getting shot through with arrows. And he said that's where the central banker should look.
Yeah, St. Sebastian.
St. Sebastian. You're exactly right.
Yeah. The Treasury wanted the Fed's help in intervening and wanted the Fed to do swap lines with other central banks. And at the time, that was quite controversial within the Federal Reserve System. The Treasury had an exchange stabilization fund, but it used a good deal of its authorization.
Wasn't big enough. We didn't have nearly that much money. I think it was $10-15 billion.
And quite a bit of it had been used to lend money to Argentina.
Yeah.
And I think Brazil.
I'm not sure it had been used, but it just wasn't big enough. All we needed was swap. We had a swap line, I think, of $10 billion with the United Kingdom, and maybe $5 or $6 billion with France. We had big swap lines out there.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't meet it through the exchange stabilization fund.
Why didn't the Treasury go to Congress? I'm curious about that. There's a discussion of this in the FOMC minutes, and when Martin wants the FOMC to warehouse funds for the Treasury. He also wants them to engage in, what we'd call today sterilized foreign exchange intervention. At first, the committee may even go to Congress and see if Congress would enlarge the swap, the authorization for the exchange stabilization fund.
Yeah, they went about. You know how that thing came about. That was a result of the devaluation of the dollar back in Roosevelt's day. So how the hell were they going to authorize more?
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing but an accounting change. When they took the dollar from, what was it, $7 an ounce to $35 an ounce,
right.
There was a huge, big accounting surplus left. And the Congress said we could use that in defense of the dollar. That was what it was. But I don't think there was one. $25-30 billion.
Mm-hmm. So there was never any, it was a question of congressional prerogative.
Well, they couldn't have done anything to increase it.
Well,
what they could have done was step, unless they wanted to devalue the dollar again, as I said, the whole thing was nothing but an accounting gimmick.
Right, but Congress could raise the limit on the extent of the assets that the Treasury could hold in the fund. It could fund it in the way it funded the IMF or other agencies.
That would have gotten kind of complex. I don't think it was ever, that was really pretty serious. I don't think Congress could have done it either. It would have taken an act of Congress would have been very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And the Congress didn't like the Exchange Stabilization Fund anyway, because we had absolute authority over it. We didn't have to go up and get an appropriation.
And so Patman would have been, in particular, he would have been critical?
Oh, not only Patman, a lot of them.
Who?
And Anderson, Wilbur Mills, a lot of those fellows. They didn't like the idea of the Treasury sitting down there with a blank check.
Mm-hmm. At that time.
They still don't. You can see a great mail about poor old Bob Rubin in Mexico.
Oh, yes. It's still an issue, of course. At that time, Willis Robertson would have been, was he at that point chairman of the South
yes,
Banking Committee?
I'm never sure how, but. Willis was a dear friend of mine. We used to go bird hunting an awful lot. He loved to go bird hunting, so did I. And he was a marvelous shot. I was never as good as he was. He was a good friend, but I don't think he was interested in the slightest in that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Beyond Willis Robertson, who were the key figures that you remember from the Senate Banking Committee, the early ones? Douglas was on it.
Douglas was on the Finance Committee.
Okay.
He was not on the Banking and Currency Committee. Douglas was in there where it counted. He was on the Finance Committee. Who else was on that Banking and Currency Committee? They didn't do much, you know.
Okay, well.
It really wasn't very important.
Mm-hmm.
I say that as an ex-member of the House Banking and Currency Committee. They didn't do much.
Mm-hmm.
Housing was about the only thing they did.
Mm-hmm. On the key issues of the day before the tax cut comes up, in particular what to do about the international situation, the problem with the dollar. The Treasury was the dominant influence.
Still was. And that's where we beat out the council and all the rest of it.
And
in that area, we, Bob Dylan, who was a good friend of Jack Kennedy, he and Jack were very good friends, and Doug and Bob ran the international area single-handed. They didn't check much with anybody.
How did Kennedy happen to appoint a Treasury?
I don't know if we're off the record or not. Kennedy thought Doug's daughter was hot stuff, and she was, too, I'll tell you. They used to go to parties all the time when Doug was over in state, when he's Under Secretary of State, and...
So there was a social connection.
Yeah, very strong social connection.
And Dylan's daughter was attractive.
You don't forget about that. She was, hell of an attractive guy. She eventually became Mrs. Luxembourg.
Mrs. Luxembourg?
Yeah, married the Duke of Luxembourg, I think.
Okay. Kennedy's father was also very conservative.
He got on me one time.
He was not a big fan of Roosevelt and the devaluation of the dollar.
He hated all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
One time he jumped all over me. There was a technical part in the Federal Reserve Act that we had to keep so much gold behind the paper money.
Oh, it was more than technical. It really can't bind.
Oh, yeah, it was binding. 68. I shouldn't say technical, but it was a binding one.
Sure.
We kept running closer and closer.
Yeah.
Honey, I went over and talked to Kennedy one time. I said, we better get rid of this damn thing. Next thing I know, I get a stinging letter, note from Ken's sponsor. Said, don't ever come up with these wild ideas, pie-in-the-sky monetary ideas again. I'm sure it was old Joe Kennedy who wrote that note.
That's funny.
Well, we didn't do it that year. We had to do it the next year. Ran out of cover.
What was Chairman Bill Martin's relationship with Kennedy? Why did Kennedy reappoint Martin? Why not somebody of the...
I'm sure his father wanted him to, and he was also certain that Bill was a very stabilizing factor with the street, with Wall Street and the financial community and the rest of the world. And he was.
Mm-hmm.
Bill was a towering figure, there's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is poor bastard still alive?
Is who?
Is Bill still alive?
Well, he is, but he's dying.
He's been dying for 15 years. Poor guy.
Well, it's been a long time since he's been able to talk to people, but my understanding is that his physical condition...
He was one of the most wonderful men I ever knew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that guy, he could come to a conclusion. You never knew how he got there. But he came to a conclusion, and he was right so often, I couldn't believe it.
Hmm.
He was an amazing fellow.
Hmm.
I was very fond of him.
Yeah, anything you can remember about him, of course, I'd love to have on tape.
He asked me to be a governor of the Fed one time, and I said, hey, I'd love to do that. I was assistant secretary for... Congressional Affairs at that time. So I went and asked Doug. He said, I think it's fine. So they sent me all up, wrote it off, went over to Kennedy. But George Mitchell, who was a big buddy of Dick Daley's in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
he decided he wanted a job, and he got it. There's nobody going to be that George. And he was right. I'm glad. I would have made a terrible governor. I've been bored stiff.
Well, you had a more interesting job, I think.
Yeah. I like the action more.
Being governor, there's a lot of public relations.
Yes,
talking
a lot
to
of
banking
them.
Groups and
yeah.
the whole business. Rosa came up with the idea of the interest equalization tax. What about the voluntary direct investment program?
That drove the business guys crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. That's what we had. We figured that money was pouring out of the country because we were investing in, as the Germans said, we were buying up their country with their money. And they were right. And the French said the same thing.
So that was Rose's idea, too? And the voluntary direct credit restraint program that the Fed inflicted on banks, that was the Treasury's idea, too?
Absolutely. That was Duncan and Dom.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the Treasury's attitude.
They were singularly unsuccessful, as you know.
Oh, sure.
Right.
There's a...
Yes, And they said, we're all entitled to one big goof in your lifetime, but I think Bob's was an interest equalization tax. I cringe every time anybody mentions that. It created the whole damn euro market, you know.
That's right. People simply started lending and borrowing abroad rather than in the United States.
Didn't take the Russians. They were the guys you thought and dreamed it up. They had all those dollars and then robbed the bank in London. They decided they were going to get in the banking business, and they did back in the early 60s. Well,
right. Yeah, they had from the gold sales.
Yep.
Let's move on to the. One more question on the Treasury's attitudes. The classical way of dealing with a balance of payments problem, gold outflows, is to raise the discount rate. Was the Treasury willing to go some distance that way?
Not very far.
Excuse me?
Not very far.
And was that because of their own natural inclinations?
And they were convinced it's going to throw the country in some kind of recession.
So in that sense, they were a lot like the Heller's Council. I mean, Heller's Council absolutely...
Exactly.
Thought that the only good interest rate was a low interest rate, and all the action should come from...
Not to get off the subject, but poor old Bob, didn't old Bob Rubin have one hell of a time riding? I noticed the Fed wants him to raise interest rates. No, it wasn't the Fed, it was Candace's, wasn't it? The head of the IMF came out with a big blast that the Fed ought to raise interest rates.
Well,
I think old Paul Rubin is playing those Japanese right where he wants them. Stupid assholes, they got themselves in this mess.
Dylan himself, when it came to raising interest rates, was...
Very concerned, very cautious.
Mm-hmm. And that's because of the experience in 1960, 59,
yeah.
When Martin raised interest rates because of the gold outflows.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot of, over that issue, there wasn't a lot of opposition between the council.
There really was.
Mm-hmm. Although at that point there was still some willingness to raise interest
that
rates.
That was no...
It was different.
It was neither he nor Rosa. And they didn't have their feet dug in sand on this,
mm-hmm.
the way Walter did.
Yeah, of course, things changed then with Johnson. And tell me a little bit about the Treasury's attitude toward the council's plans for a tax cut. The council had the idea that the economy was operating way below its capacity, and it wanted a big deficit to move the economy up. Nothing happened for a long time, and that was because of Kennedy's caution.
Kennedy's caution and Dillon's caution.
The Berlin Wall and the gold outflows, and the whole international situation.
Right.
In the summer of 62, apparently the Treasury became willing to talk about a tax cut. The economy appeared to be slowing down.
One of the big things that influenced us, we were working with a 90% top rate. 90%?
Right. So Dylan viewed it as a vehicle for a tax
reform. Well, it was just nonsense. He just viewed it as some way to rationalize the tax structure, and he was right.
Mm-hmm.
And also, he wanted to plug a few loopholes. He wanted to do something about expense accounts. Kennedy kept saying, no more three martini lunches. I never knew anybody had three martini lunches, but that was Kennedy's view anyway. And then Doug had some other things he wanted to do, but expense accounts was one of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
we've talked about Dylan and Rosa. Did you have much contact with Paul Volcker at that time?
Oh, sure.
Do you remember anything you can tell me at this point about
Volcker? Oh, in those days when Dylan was there, was not in a position of great authority. He was our economist. He was sitting up on the next floor, on the fourth floor, grinding out the economic data, and we saw him a lot then, but not much in the policy formation.
Mm-hmm.
Came into the policy formation much later when Fowler came in and I came in. That's when Paul really started going. But in the Kennedy days, no.
Did he do debt management at that time, or was it...
No, Rosa did it.
Mm-hmm. When Johnson became president, why did he make the tax cut his top priority? Why did he go with that as his major?
He was a good politician. He probably was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was good reason for that. Again, we moved it from 90 to 70, but 70 was still a terrible rate. Mm-hmm. And there was pretty good evidence to show that the, I think Dan Suri, who was one of the brightest men in the Treasury, I think he was convinced, too, that the tax system was a burden on our economy. We ought to, mm-hmm. ought to straighten it up a little bit. And so there was not all that much objection to it. Mm-hmm. I remember old Harry Bird, when I was over there with Johnson one day, and Johnson called Harry, and Harry said, well, he said, look, he said, I'll move that tax bill of yours now, Mr. President, but he said, you've got to come in with a budget under $100 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that, under $100 billion?
Yeah.
And it wasn't much more than that, about 115, I think, but we're positive. But Johnson got old McNamara, and they whacked off $15 billion. And Harry was right. He moved the tax bill.
Yeah, I think that caused some heartache for the Heller Council. They wanted at least the Galbraith wing wanted they wanted a deficit, but they'd rather have it through expenditure increases than a tax cut. And they had to swallow.
Exactly.
They had to swallow.
It didn't make much difference. They didn't have the vote.
Yeah. So the tax cut passed. Was there a feeling that after the tax cut passed that was not a good time for the Fed to raise interest rates? As it turned out, 1964 was a pretty strong year for money growth. Was Martin constrained? I know at the time.
You know, by that time I was over the FDIC.
So that
didn't see as much of Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I had the feeling he was constrained. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was
over there for a year and I didn't see Bill much.
The statements that were coming out of Congress, well, Patman, of course, you know, said that if the Fed now raises interest rates, it will be thwarting the will of Congress to stimulate the economy.
What a guy that old man was.
We'll get back to Patman in a minute. Do you have any? Of course, I was around at this point, but I wasn't. I was just a student. The 1964 elections were really important for changing the character of Congress so that social legislation could get through programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And that was because the Southern Democrats lost the stranglehold they had on committees. Can you tell me anything about that?
Exactly. My old Johnson just came in there and, wow, boy, he knew how to run things. He grabbed that Congress and shook it up. He knew that when I was in the Congress, I'd always opposed Medicare and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him when he appointed me when I went over as Undersecretary of the Treasury, I said, I oppose this stuff. He said, I know it and I don't give a goddamn.
Well, he was very fiscally conservative, too, when he was a senator in the 50s.
That's true.
But he just had this sense that, I mean, he knew right away that
Duffy's called. He was going to pass it.
That Congress had changed, so he...
Oh, he wanted it, personally, too.
Mm-hmm.
Old Lennon was a real radical. He really wanted to do things for the poor people of this country, no question.
I mean, he saw himself as a protege of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. That was his ideal.
Yeah.
And what were the key changes in Congress that made it possible to get through Great Society legislation?
I'm not sure there were that many key changes. There were some, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What old Lyndon did, just went up there and grabbed everybody and twisted their arms, you know, and shoved it through. There weren't that many changes. There weren't that changes in ways and means or banking and currency or all those places. Yeah, we won maybe 15, 20 seats. Picked up 20, 30 seats in the 1964 election, but that was all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were the big crucial seats.
Mm-hmm.
He just rode over.
Okay. I was curious. I read your oral history from the Johnson Library, and
mm-hmm.
there's a sentence in there where You say that Johnson offered you the job as congressional liaison for the White House, but you said you couldn't work that closely with Johnson, and then...
The other night, the Marines bombed those Pleiku barracks. Mm-hmm. The Vietnamese took that Pleiku barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson went mad, and I thought, boy, I'm not going to work this close with this madman. I told my wife to go home and start back, and we were going home. And then he put Fowler in his secretary, and I rushed over to see Fowler, and I said, you got to save me from this madman. I said, I don't want to go over there and be legislative liaison, and so I went over to the Treasury with Joe.
So you saw Johnson lose his temper and thought that you didn't want to be that close to...
That's right. I was very fond of Lyndon. Lyndon was one of the greatest men, one of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
He was either a saint or a sinner or maybe anything. That was Lyndon.
Mm-hmm.
He was damn good to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been very deeply fond of him. We fought like bad, but he was very, quite a man.
Yeah, you mentioned that, again, without following up. What there was a very funny line in one of your oral histories where you have Johnson telling you that he was tired as hell of having you always saying no to him, and he was going to get him a Peace Corps type to have around.
He said he's going
to
send me to the Peace Corps.
What kinds of things did you have to argue with him about?
Oh, he decided he's going to micromanage the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to approve all the debt issues and everything else. I had to get his signature on a lot of little, old, tiny debt issues. And I never could find him. One time I had to dig him out of that barbershop. That's when he got so mad that he's going to send me to the Peace Corps. But he's just micromanagement stuff.
Why did he care about things, you know?
He had a dear, very good friend up in New York. Andre Meyer, you know, the big investment banker. He told him that the only way to stop this flood of agency issues hitting the market was for he, Lyndon, to personally okay them all. And that's what he decided to do, and that's where we got a lot of fights.
Okay. How did you become close to Henry Fowler? Was that just working with him?
Just working with him.
Mm-hmm. And, obviously, you know, Fowler became Treasury Secretary. It was a different sort of a Treasury under Fowler. Fowler had been a lawyer. He'd come from humble origins. I guess he came from West Virginia.
Yeah.
Very different than Dillon.
Well, North Virginia.
How is the Treasury run differently under Fowler than under Dillon?
Not that much. Fowler was a great, he was kind of an academic himself. We had Paul Volcker in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Debt management. We had Fred Deming, who was a Fed maven, who was running, he was the Undersecretary for International Affairs.
Right.
And we had Stan Serious, so we just, the atmosphere didn't change that much, Bob. It was, it kind of ran on the same mold. I didn't notice that much of a change.
Mm. And key decisions within the Treasury were generally made by consensus with you and Fowler and Deming,
that's right.
Surrey and Volcker.
Right.
I don't get the feeling that there was much disagreement over key issues.
No, there wasn't. We were all pretty much in agreement.
What about the Ackley Council? Did you work?
Yeah, he was a great fellow.
Did you work easily with him?
Yeah, very dear.
He had a Hunter
was not nearly as tough as Walter.
Not nearly as what?
As tough. As persistent or as determined to get his way as Walter Heller. Sargent was a marvelous fellow.
I had the feeling that when it came to things that he really policy, tax cut, tax increases, whatever, particularly when it came to the Fed, that Ackley was pretty persistent in trying to get Johnson.
Oh, yeah, he could be, but he's never, he didn't hold a candle to Walter. Walter was tough.
Well, that's an interesting. General, did the Treasury and Council see eye to eye on economic matters? Were there times when...
I don't think we had many disagreements, though. I don't think so.
early 66, the council wanted a tax increase, and the Fowler wasn't ready to sign on yet.
They got ready pretty soon. Except me was ready.
Let me ask you about now. That began the time when the Defense Department didn't want to make an estimate of what its defense expenditures were going to be. It just wanted to ask for supplemental appropriations.
That's right.
And that must have made your life at the Treasury very complicated.
Sure as hell did.
And also your relations with Congress.
Relationships with McNamara and the Defense Department. Oh, well, made mine. Fowler was very fond of Bob. I'm very fond of Bob McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
Poor bastard is just going through hell right now. But God almighty, the things, the mistakes they made. And Fowler didn't agree. Fowler and I really disagreed on that Vietnam War.
Well, Fowler was a hawk.
Oh, boy, was he. He still is.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was. I think the difference was I had a very tough, I should say this, but I had a very tough World War II. I did a lot of fighting and killing. I lost 15 men one time, World War II, and I've never forgotten it. And that makes me a little bit more cautious.
Yeah. Well,
at any rate.
Yeah.
But I hated that war. And,
Do you think one reason McNamara wasn't willing to make unbiased estimates of defense expenditures for a whole fiscal year, that he felt that if the country had to vote for the war, that would engender a debate that
big
would...
society problems, that's what he did. Why, he was extremely reluctant to do that.
Let's say that again, I didn't quite hear that. What did
if he had come out with the solid estimates on the cost of Vietnam, Congress would have voted down as Lyndon's big, great society broker.
Yeah. So that really ruled out your ability to get a tax increase from Congress, too, wasn't it? I mean, if you'd wanted a tax increase in 65 and 66, you would have had to say, well, we need this amount of money to spend for the war, but if you aren't giving estimates of what it's going to cost to spend on the war, you can't say, well, we need a tax increase to pay for expenditures you aren't willing to be explicit about.
Right.
Why didn't Johnson early on wrap himself in the flag and go for a tax increase in the whole...
As I say, he was bound and determined he was going to get these great society programs authorized and funded, and he did. And then he kind of calmed down a little bit.
Well, and he must have felt, too, that the Congress he had working with up through fall of 66 was probably about the best he was ever going to get.
I think that's true.
And he didn't want
to... But right, too.
He didn't want to... Yeah, Democrats didn't do too well in the fall of 66, and so it could have been a problem for a lot of them to have to vote for a tax increase.
How are we coming? I'm an old man. I'm getting a little weary.
Well, we're moving along. We have a couple more years to go. Okay. Would you like to postpone this and do it, finish another time?
How about Monday morning? I left office. Every damned economist in the country said that we put in the Great Society program and did nothing to pay for it. We raised taxes and froze spending, and when I left office, I turned in a balance, a little surplus on her domestic account and a surplus on an international account.
Yeah, absolutely.
1969
was the last year of a balanced budget.
Exactly.
So, and the
you did that by raising taxes.
The budget deficits that were scaring people at the time were like $30 billion.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So people lose a sense of perspective, and I'm sorry, I'm a pain in the, but this is important to get your feelings. Okay, so we're back to the fall 65. The Council of Economic Advisers had the idea that for all through the 1960s there had been a output gap, that full employment output was higher than actual output, and the council had always been arguing for fiscal policy, for tax cuts to try to eliminate that output gap. And through most of 65, that was still the feeling of the council. There was still an output gap, but it wasn't time to try to put in place restrictive fiscal or monetary policies. But that began to change in the at the very end of 1965. And in your tape, you've got an interesting comment I thought you might be willing to elaborate on it. You say, or the questioner says, the Federal Reserve raised the discount rate without consultation from the administration economic advisors. And you say, not much consultation, and we had a big fight at that time. That was one of the bitterest arguments that we had within the administration.
Well, Bill Martin raised rates.
Yeah.
When we weren't looking. And we just went through the roof.
But I had the feeling that from your discussion here that you were sympathetic with the Fed, that you may have taken, that you may have...
I wasn't at the time. In retrospect, I think the Fed was right. At the time, I was very angry. I thought that they put the blocks to the
So there was no... So you said we had a big fight with Martin.
That's correct.
Okay, that wasn't clear from the... From
the Fed didn't call it down to the ranch, too, you know.
Did Johnson come close to asking for Martin's resignation? Was
no.
He? No.
No.
But he was pretty angry. I've read
the... Fast as hell. We all were. What happened? We did have no idea it was coming.
Well, Martin had been telling Johnson for a long time that he was going to raise the discount rate, and Johnson kept saying, no, not yet, I'm going to have my gallbladder out, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have my gallbladder out, would you? And, I mean, Martin thought that Johnson was willing to countenance an increase because he, Johnson, wasn't willing to go ahead and ask for a tax increase, but that was more of a misunderstanding, apparently.
Yeah.
But they made it up at the ranch. From then on, there's no there's no open
things happen.
The board was concerned that the wage and price.
But what happened here was that Bill had the correct information and we had bum information.
Mm-hmm.
Bob McNamara was lying to us, and he would tell us these. What he did was send up, instead of sending up a big appropriation, he sent up all these goddamn supplementals. And you had to sort through all the supplementals to find out what the hell he was doing. And Bill didn't figure it out. No, Senator Russell told him what was going on.
Right. He just talked to the head of the House and Senate Armed Forces committees.
Yeah. Dick Russell told him what was happening. And based on that, Fowler and I should have been screaming for it, too, but we didn't have that information. That goddamn Vietnam War stuff, it was terrible.
And the OMB, Charlie Schultz, he didn't...
Charlie wasn't much better, you're right. We remember one year we started off our conferences early in the morning, somebody said, Charlie, how are we going to get the straight dope? You're going to give us that bullshit again.
That would have been fall 1966?
It could well have been, I don't know. No, it was in January. It was January of 66, I think.
Mm-hmm.
66 or 67, one or the other. They had no hesitation about lying to us.
Did in 1965, did you get involved boning bankers to keep the prime rate down?
Not really.
Mm-hmm. There's a memo here from Fowler to the president that says, we should invite any banker making inquiries about raising the prime rate to come in and talk with Barr, Volcker, or Martin.
Yeah.
Okay. But Johnson got involved in that somewhat.
Yeah.
I got it. Okay. So the the
they hadn't learned yet that you can't control markets. Bob Rubin's learned it well, hadn't he?
Yeah, he's a little more philosophical about it.
I tell you, he's taking those old Japanese right into the cleaners this time.
Yeah.
He mousetrapped them. Couldn't happen to nicer people.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, but I think it was... the Fed then did go ahead and raise rates in the summer of 1966. Martin was in the hospital, but I assume he was in agreement. And
yep.
You sent a memorandum to Marvin Watson at the time, basically defending them. You said, "Marvin, we are in a tough position. The president's three appointees on the Federal Reserve Board, Mazel, Robertson, and Brimmer, plus the other liberal Democrat, Mitchell, hold a majority on the board. These four men insist that we have to have a hard money policy in this country at this time. These are not reactionary Republicans. They are liberal Democrats with long records. I do not know any reasonable men who disagree with them. They feel they are doing what is right for the country and taking enormous heat. I think the best and most honorable course is to do what we have done in this last episode, and that is to remain silent when Mr. Patman takes out after them. We do not need to protect the Fed at this moment, but on the other hand, I do not think we should try to crucify them." So you were tacitly willing to...
By that time, we'd accepted it. We were getting ready to start pushing for a tax bill by that time. We could see what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Vietnam and looked around out there, and I came back and told the president, I said, "You can see that bullshit that they're giving us is not true just by watching them pour concrete." And he said, "Well," but you talked to McNamara, and I talked to Bob, and he said, "Well, it's all going to be down here." He said, "You're right." He said, "Maybe we've been wrong, but it's all going to be over by 1967.
Yeah, he really
did. He really thought that.
He really did believe that by June 1967 that...
And when it was not, he quit.
Yeah.
Boy, he was a tragic guy. But I don't believe he helped himself a damn bit. But.
No, none of that came out in the book, apparently. He still waffles about why he resigned. Anyways,
I'm sure he resigned. He thinks he might have been fired.
Well, yeah. Anyways.
Why do you suppose Republicans are after Andy Brimmer? They're not going to confirm him as head of this control board here in the district. I can't imagine. Can you?
He's very liberal Democratic. I talked to him about a month ago, and
yeah, that's true.
He's very intelligent.
He's
political, and he's definitely liberal Democratic. So I don't quite understand. I don't understand.
Anybody be dumb enough to take the job? Well, they'd get a medal anyway.
Well, it's not one that I would. Let me ask you about the extension of Regulation Q in this period. You know, it was extended to the thrifts. Were you involved in negotiating with Congress to lower Reg Q rates that banks could pay on savings deposits? And
yes, I was. It didn't fight much of a chord.
Congress was under enormous pressure from the housing lobby at that time. I mean, the housing lobby was really, really, really strong.
That's true. Don't have that. Mm-hmm.
And on one side, you had Wright Patman, who wanted to pass a single legislative ceiling on all bank deposits, by law, 4.5%. Does that ring a bell?
Not really, not a lot.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
some of that stuff kind of boring. Taxes were much more interesting than regulations, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember negotiating with the banking committees on Reg Q? And
the thing I remember is when all the SNL started getting in problems, and I remember some of the California SNL got in real problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to the place where I said, "Well, to hell with it, I'm going to put some taxes and loan accounts in these SNLs instead of in banks, rather than see them go down the tube."
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I remember. I can't remember the negotiation.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember where the quarter, where the differential between thrifts and banks came in? Do you remember that being discussed at the time?
I don't remember.
Okay. Wright Patman this was his hour of glory. At least he had signed on a fair number of congressmen and to pass legislation for interest rate ceilings on the Fed. How significant a force was he at that time? Was the Fed's independence ever?
Oh, sure. Patman screamed and yelled a lot, but he didn't really. He didn't. You know, I think if push came to shove, he would have backed down. Bill knew it.
And that was because he was really more interested in.
In the publicity.
And kind of basically doing things for the SNLs in his own area rather than.
He didn't want to make monetary policy.
Okay. I talked to some people who worked on his staff at that time, and that's what they told me exactly that. But he certainly didn't.
He wasn't dumb enough to get into that mare's nest, you know. That's hard business.
Yeah.
It's much simpler to stand back and be a screaming populist.
What about the role of the Senate Banking Committee? Up until the fall when he was defeated, Willis Robertson was chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, and Harkman became.
Oh, Willis, I wonder.
Excuse me?
Who beat Willis Roberts?
Mm.
Yeah, I remember. Well.
Oh, yeah, that's embarrassing. I'm from Virginia.
Me too. And, I can't think of.
I'll come up with it in.
Okay.
In a minute. But they also can. Basically, even though they were quiet, they tacitly supported the Fed. There was no chance that they would have joined with Patman attacking the Fed.
No.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, there really is not that much interest. It's extremely difficult to campaign on monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely. Nobody understands it. Nobody gives a damn.
Yeah.
Pay high interest rates, yeah. Now, they can understand that. But the connection with the Fed and all the esoteric ramifications, that's not good campaign material.
Yeah. Okay. You've got a statement in your tape. You say, the lesson taken away from the credit crunch was that restrictive monetary policy works through killing off the housing industry. Without fiscal policy, you're forced to rely completely on monetary policy by the Federal Reserve Board, and that has some very disturbing consequences. Whenever you tighten monetary policy, it kills home building right off the bat.
It does. I stand to that.
Uh-huh. In that summer, the Fed got involved in trying to jawbone banks to ration loans without raising rates.
Wasn't that crazy? You look back and see the crazy things you did.
They sent a letter to the member banks.
I know.
Were you involved in those discussions at all with
the Fed? I'm sure I wasn't. It was one of the more foolish things I've been involved in.
But at that time, there was a consensus that developed within the Fed and Johnson's advisors that there should be a tax increase as opposed to an increase in interest rates. You alluded to that earlier.
Starting about 67.
The only issue was getting Johnson to sign on to it.
The biggest issue was getting Johnson to agree to a spending limit. He didn't want to agree to a spending limit. He didn't want to raise taxes, but even less did he want to have somebody put a spending clamp on him.
So in the fall of 1966, that was the first time where Johnson's advisors kind of as a group all got together and tried to push him in going to go for a... But it kind of... He gave a speech and recommended getting rid of the investment tax credit. There were some changes in depreciation. There were fairly minor changes
right.
at that point. But the Fed then did go ahead and begin to lower interest rates. I mean, was the assumption that, or at least the hope that Johnson would ask for a tax increase in the State of the Union address? And so
no, I think the problem, they felt, that the economy was slowing down a little more than they anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
That was the rationale here, I think.
Mm-hmm. But then Johnson did ask for a tax increase in January 67, but then didn't send a proposal to Congress.
Yeah.
So, but at that point then, Martin's pretty aggressive about lowering interest rates. So, I mean, the assumption, he must have been going on the understanding that as soon as the economy did strengthen, the administration would send a tax bill to Congress?
You know, Fowler was handling that, and that was pretty tight negotiations. I'm not sure just what did transpire. Could you excuse me? I'm going to the bathroom a minute.
Oh, sure. I'm here. Let me ask you about fall 1967 and the depreciation of the, or the devaluation of the pound. The economy had grown strongly for 6 months or so, and the tax negotiations had gone nowhere at that point, and yet Martin still wasn't willing to raise rates. Part of the reason, apparently, was that there was a fear that he didn't want to set off, he didn't want to precipitate a devaluation of the pound. What was the worst case scenario? Was it felt that if the speculators successfully attacked?
Remember, we were on the gold standard then.
Right.
And it was a very, very compelling standard, too. We were convinced that I think we took it too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
We thought it was a real tragedy if the British valued and knocked us down. And that was the real concern.
There was a feeling that if the speculators knocked the pound off, they would then go on to the gold pool.
That's correct.
You'd have to close the gold pool, and if they closed the gold pool, then the dollar might. So there was a real feeling, even in fall of 67, that there might be a forced devaluation of the dollar.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's what helped us pass the tax bill. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the only thing that passed the tax bill. Congress understood the gold standard there.
Yeah. Let's talk about the tax bill. Johnson sent the tax surcharge proposal to Congress in August 1967,
right,
and got a chilly reception from Wilbur Mills. The key issue was always spending cuts.
That's correct.
And I mean, a lot of the liberal Democrats weren't willing to sign on to a tax increase. First of all, they didn't care that much about inflation, but they were worried about the cities. They didn't want to do anything to raise unemployment. They weren't exactly enthusiastic about voting taxes to pay for the war. So Mills had to sign on a lot of conservative Democrats and some Republicans. And I mean, he had a problem. He had to show some tax cuts. Is that a good reading of the situation?
Spending cuts is what he had to show.
I mean, spending cuts. That's what I meant. But Johnson wasn't willing to compromise on that issue until...
He hated that like a poison. One of the last things he said to me, we were having dinner at the White House just before he left, went back to Texas. He said, whatever happened to that spending limitation bill? That I didn't even notice the damn thing.
He was mad about the cuts, but he also was mad about the way they were going to be done, that
Congress was going to tell him what to do.
Congress was going to appropriate more money than it was willing to, but it was going to pass a lower spending limitation bill, so Johnson had to take the political heat for the particular cuts.
He hated that.
And he thought Congress ought to be doing that. So he and Mills really fell out during this period, all 67, first part of...
Their friendship was not improved, let's put it that way.
Okay, so then the gold pool, the dollar... I really loved your descriptions of this period in spring, 1960, raising, terrified, scared to death. you made it sound pretty convincing that you were really...
We were really terrified of the gold standard.
Really?
Absolutely. We were convinced the first guy who took us off the gold standard was going to be ridden out of town on a rail.
Yeah.
Said, the guy, John Connolly, did it, and he ran for president.
genius to turn it around into an attack on the Japanese and defending American jobs, but it wasn't viewed that time.
We were just overblowing it. It was George Shultz was right. He said we need some benign neglect, mm-hmm. and we had convinced ourselves that it was our rackets.
But even though, given all the
another one of the misconceptions of the Vietnam War.
Even given all the pressure you were, you know, you felt that you were under, there was never any serious consideration to the orthodox medicine of raising interest rates.
No.
And that's because Johnson wasn't willing to...
The economy wasn't that good either. Mm-hmm. We're raising taxes. We mm-hmm. slowed things down.
Mm-hmm.
What we did, we made, after we got taxes raised and things slowed down a little bit, the Fed did step in and cut interest rates.
Mm-hmm. That was in summer. Well, the tax bill was passed, signed June 28th.
Yeah. Shortly after that, the Fed cut rates or lowered them. I don't know if they cut rates or not, but they
actually did lower rates.
And that started off a little inflationary boom.
Was there a concern? I mean, was there a concern about the timing of the tax increase? The fact that it came a whole year late and came before the elections, and that it might have,
there probably was, but there wasn't anything we could do about it. I don't know how the hell we ever got that thing done anyway.
Well, you just
stuff.
You just
I worked day and night on that thing.
You just suggested one reason. You could go to Congress and you could tell them if you don't pass this, the international
gold standard's going to collapse on us.
And people had seen what happened to Britain, and
exactly.
That was something that
Congress could understand.
Could take home and say, well, you know, I don't want to do it, but we can't let the world trading system collapse.
Yep, exactly.
But then there was a fear of overkill, that the tax surcharge would dampen economic activity too much, so that the administration pushed on the Fed to lower interest rates. The regional banks were reluctant to go along with that, and the council pushed a bill to take the regional bank presidents off the Federal Reserve Board. Were you involved in that at all, or?
That's a favorite old ploy of theirs, though. One of the best people on the Open Market Committee, those regional bank presidents.
At least the council was taking it very seriously. The council wanted to get the bank presidents off, but you weren't involved in that at all.
I didn't believe in that bullshit.
Yeah. Good. I had one more question about the international situation. In March, when the gold pool was closed, there was Martin and Fowler worked on an international coordination among central banks whereby we would raise our interest rates moderately and they would keep theirs unchanged so that you would have a differential between countries that would encourage capital flows into the U.S., but the economies of the major industrial powers would continue strongly. Does that ring a bell, those negotiations?
Yeah. Yes, they did that. Fowler mm-hmm. was deeply engaged at that time in working out an amendment to the International Monetary Fund called the Special Drawing Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always gone. He was gone, I bet, two-thirds of the time while I was undersecretary. He's always traveling around the world selling the Special Drawing Rights. And I was left with the tender mercies of Lyndon Johnson.
So you're the one that bore the brunt of his ill humor when he was in a bad mood.
He questioned frequently was.
You mentioned that Martin was involved in the congressional headcount on the vote to repeal the gold cover, and you've got a great description of that. He had...
Where are you quoting from? I don't remember all this stuff.
I've got... There's two sources. You did two tapes for the LBJ Library.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all
and,
right.
This is from that tape, but there's also memoranda that you wrote that are at the LBJ Library that I have, with, and I read to you the memorandum, Marvin Watson, and there's some others.
That's some library. That,
yeah, so it's those two things.
Okay.
How much lobbying did he do with Fowler to get the tax bill through? And it, I know he...
I don't think he did much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it had been appropriate for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was an inappropriate. Bill was had a very strong sense of propriety in that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he got involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Then you stayed on and obviously became Secretary of the Treasury the end of 68. You developed a good working relationship with David Kennedy.
Dave was an old buddy of mine. We were old pals back from Chicago days. I'm a Midwesterner, you know, and I've known Dave most of my life. And he's a great fellow.
So you knew him while he was at Continental?
Yeah, sure.
How did that happen?
I'm not sure. I think I don't know whether it was in college or whether it was business or what. But I've known Dave practically forever. He's a marvelous man.
What can you tell me about him? Was he more like Dylan than the things and the way he thought about policy and ran the Treasury? And
I don't know. I never thought of that comparison. He's a very pragmatic kind of a fellow. And I was very fond of Dave. I don't think he made a particularly effective Secretary of the Treasury, but I was extremely fond of him.
Mm-hmm. I have been to the Nixon Library. There are not a lot of memoranda from him. It's a very different... From the LBJ Library, there are memoranda all the time from the Treasury to Johnson. The Treasury's clearly very much involved in quadriad meetings, you know, the triad meetings, economic policy. There's not... Until Shultz becomes Secretary of Treasury, there's not as much in the way of memoranda and things from Kennedy. They're just missing, or he wasn't as strong a player?
I doubt it. I don't think he and Nixon were very close buddies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were very, very close friends. That was my impression. I don't know.
And Nixon?
He got that job, you know, and became a roving ambassador, which was kind of a fancy name for nothing.
And he just wasn't, Nixon didn't feel like he was of that much use to him, so.
I guess, I don't know. I really can't answer that question. But you could see that he was not carrying a big, heavy club in that event. Nixon was wild about John Connally. He thought John Connally was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, along with wage and price controls.
Yep.
The import surcharge and all those things. Yeah, they were just wonderful. Was Kennedy helpful in persuading Nixon to accept the tax surcharge?
Extremely. He wanted it. He knew we needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very helpful in getting it done.
And I mean,
Johnson, though, I think we finally called Nixon up and said, you better do this. And I think he persuaded him.
Mm-hmm.
He and Nixon were old buddies. People didn't know them, and they were close friends.
Oh, from when Johnson was Senate majority.
Yep.
Well, that's...
Well, they'd been in the Congress together about 30 years, you know.
Did you ever go to any of the quadriad meetings? Did you ever have that kind of contact with Martin, Bill Martin?
No, I'm not even sure what the quadriad was.
Oh, that was where the Treasury Secretary, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, and the head of the Bureau of the Budget would meet with... Bill Martin, and also the president, and they would meet anywhere from 7 to 10, 11 times a year, and they'd basically, Martin would give the administration advice on fiscal policy, and then the administration would give Martin advice on monetary policy, and they would try to bargain and trade. And
I guess I didn't know about that, but mm-hmm. No, I was not involved.
Martin would come over to the Treasury on Monday.
On Mondays for lunch.
And then you and Fowler at times would talk to him afterwards?
Yeah.
So you just exchange information. Can you tell me anything about those meetings and
sit around, shot the bull, and
And after December 65, there was basic agreement between the Treasury and the Fed that the burden of restrictive policy should be shifted from monetary to fiscal policy.
Right.
And there were, you don't remember, I mean, basically your recollection is that the discussions were pretty, you were pretty much of one mind in the way
yep.
you looked at things?
Yep.
Can I ask you just quickly, you didn't leave the, after you...
Hold on a minute. God damn it! Dog out there chasing my horse. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. After what you said about academics, I'm a little bit gun-shy. I didn't know. I thought maybe I was overstaying my welcome here, and you, yeah, I pushed you over some kind of limit.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, let me know, because I'm just about
done. Just about done, though, Bob. I'll tell you. About one more question, and that's it.
Yeah. You were a member of the advisory council, a federal advisory council for 2 years.
That's right.
At the Richmond Fed. So you had some contact with Arthur Burns at that time?
Very much. Arthur was a dear old buddy of mine.
So how did you happen... How had you known Arthur Burns?
I knew him when he was... he and I were on a Buckley show one time. Hmm. Bill Buckley show, when I was in the Treasury and he was still an academic.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just kind of developed a very close relationship. Arthur and his wife were very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy.
How would you characterize his relationship with... the Nixon administration.
He's a very powerful man in it.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur was one hell of a politician, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm. And he continued to exercise influence in it?
I'm not as much, no, but mm-hmm. He had plenty.
Why do you think he advocated wage and price control? So why?
Didn't remember that he did.
Well, he was the earliest, long before the Nixon
administration. They got a bug up their ass that inflation was going to kill us back there in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was what really was.
Mm-hmm. And then after you became CEO at Franklin National?
I went across the street and became chairman of American Security.
Right.
And then I stayed there about 5 years and got in the fight with my directors and retired to the farm. And then Dave Kennedy called me and asked me to come up and try to bail out Franklin.
So that was after Franklin got into trouble.
That's right.
You went to.
And Bill Simon asked me to go up and see if I could give him a hand. And so I went up, and the Fed wasn't going to loan him any more money. The Bank of New York, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, wasn't going to loan him any more money. So they had somebody in there they knew, and I guess I fit the bill. That thing worked out pretty well, too. We got, you know, we got paid everybody off, paid off the Fed, the FDIC, I think all the bondholders, and the shareholders might even get a few pennies out of that thing sooner or later.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.